Father in heaven, I just want to take a few minutes right now to invite your spirit here. I thank you for the interest in this particular topic. And Lord, it is my goal not only to have this founded on Bible principles, but also to have it very practical. And I pray that your will be worked in that vein, because I believe you want us to know how to apply things that we learn. And I just ask you to guide in Jesus' name. Amen. Just want to mention to you that at the end of this session, we have, I think, up to 20 of the DVDs. If you don't plan to be at the booths tonight, then it would be really, I think, helpful if you wanted to pick one up, if you'd like to have a copy from our... It is basically the same thing. It is some first fruits of what we've produced in our studio, so don't look at it as a professional job. It actually involves students from two schools, high schools, and my husband and I are just learning how to do this, okay? And I just want to say I'm very thankful that I'm here, because I am sharing stuff with you that I actually learned in a secular world, in the secular world, in secular settings, but came back to the Bible and found where they were in the scriptures. You know, we can get blinders on ourselves, and we don't always see things the way that they really are until we get an introduction from some other angle. But I'd like to just give you this one introduction, and it comes from Luke 2:52. It's kind of a foundation. If you have your Bibles, you're welcome to look at it. If not, we're going to read it together. Some of you know it by heart, and you can say it with me. And I haven't got it here yet, but I'm just going to say it to you. And Jesus increased in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and man. Okay? Have you ever heard that one before? That is an actual, really a map of how we often ask, what did Jesus do? Well, how did Jesus grow? How did he increase? And what I want to share with you is that he increased in four dimensions. Typically, we think of body, mind, and soul, or the body, spirit, and soul, or whatever. But Jesus grew in a four-dimensional way. As a church, as any church, really, we have been very good at the mental. We have established and have the largest Protestant school system in the world. But believe me, the Catholics and all missionaries and people, when they go into areas, they start schools. People have to read to be able to read the Bible, right? We are smart enough to know that the spiritual domain, the conversion part of Christianity, does not teach people how to read and write. We have to intentionally teach to that. We have to intentionally teach mathematics and all of these things and how to use computers. We know that we don't say to someone, well, honey, if you can't read, you just pray, you get converted, and that'll take care of that. We know that, right? And the same thing with the physical domain. As a denomination, as a church, we have especially let out in a health message and in both preventive kinds of institutions as well as healing type of institutions. We're not the only one. We all know that Baptists and Catholics and Episcopalians and everybody has hospitals and clinics and things. They believe in the body and taking care of the body. And that's really, really important. We don't often tell people, now I do know one particular little thread of faith I run into, that to go to a doctor is a breach of faith. But for us as a church, we don't say, get converted and God will take care of your allergies. Okay? Or get converted and you'll know how to eat healthfully. It'll just happen. No, we intentionally teach to these things. We even intentionally teach to quitting smoking. All right? So we have intentional, and the same with the spiritual, of course. We have our schools of evangelism, our Bible courses in our colleges, and our evangelistic and church, our Sabbath school lesson, we're intentionally teaching to the social domain. But the last domain, which is in favor with man, as a church, as many churches even, we have not intentionally taught to this. Yet we've all recognized that the reason that people leave the church many times is because of a social hurt. We know that we have dysfunction in our families, in our organizations, our schools. The pain many times comes in the social domain. And what our group is doing is trying to address more intentionally things in the social domain. And that's what you're here for. And we're starting starting out with Christian conflict resolution. We want it to be Bible resolved and Bible based. And that's what our goal is here. So that's our foundation. I would like to say to you, when it comes to conflict, that there are several ways that people deal with conflict. And they typically, they've been lined up with C's, which makes them easy to understand. They are coercion, capitulation, compromise, coexistence, and consensus. And the consensus is no losers, all winners. And we're going to cover that today. Okay? So we're going to see a video of some of the students that is going to illustrate these different ones. And it's, the setting is four friends get together to go out once a month to a restaurant. And this is that one of these friends has an allergy to MSG, so it limits what restaurants she can go to. And this is a illustration of capitulation. Did you ever stop to think that voting is a form of coercion? There are winners and losers. And you can get pretty emotionally and value conflicted with the outcome of certain votes, can't you? Elections and what all. So, but this is how they solve this. And every time you go into a board meeting or anything and you take a vote and there's people who are voting against it, but the majority carries, you have engaged in coercion. Because there's winners and losers, and the majority rules, and the minority loses. Okay? Now we're going to see capitulation. Capitulation is you give in because it's not worth the fight. All right? Is there a winner and a loser in that? Yeah, you can see the winner and the loser. Winners and the loser. All right, I'm going to be really sick. I'm going to go. It's not worth the fight. Let's go to the next one, which is compromise. And compromise, we often use compromise as a good resolution. Have you ever heard somebody say to you, don't get yourself into a compromising situation? So you know it has components of not such good things. But we use compromise a lot to try, oh, we came to a good compromise. We met a compromise. That means we won some and we lost some. So all parties have winning components and all parties have losing components. And let's see how that goes here. Kind of won some and lost some. They compromised. They really wanted to do Chinese. They hadn't done that before. But they're giving in so they can get her to come so she won't be sick. And yet they're not getting to do what they really, really wanted to do, which was do something totally different. All right, now the next one is coexistence. When we did, I did this as a skit in Europe, and a young Italian wife and mother, these gals just got together and helped me do this for this talk I was in with Outpost Centers. And when she learned coexistence, she said, "Oh my, coexistence is mean." And it kind of woke me up, because I'll tell you what, it's the fiber of a whole lot of marriages and long-term relationships in offices and businesses. So watch it and see how it becomes coexistence when you cannot resolve it, so you go your ways, okay? Introvert marry an extrovert, and the extrovert tries to drag the introvert out to all the social activities, and the extrovert's miserable, or introvert's miserable, or they try to get the other one to stay home and they want to be out. And so what eventually, after a period of time, do you do? The extrovert goes, the introvert stays. That's called coexistence. Okay? Now, all of these are okay. We can't always reach consensus in everything, which is win-win. We can't. We should work for it, but we can't always. And so what we do is we kind of use these different tactics. But what I want to say to you is this. If you find a particular tactic being used pretty consistently, and one person is doing all the capitulating or all the coercion or whatever it is, and it's a red flag. It's become sort of a habit and not winning. And coexistence, we do have to coexist in some things because we have a clash of deep values and past family experiences, and we just can't come to a meeting of the mind. But the more coexistence you see in a relationship, the red flag. And how many of you have ever heard someone say, well, we live in the same house, but that's about it? Anybody ever heard people say that? Ever seen it? That's called coexistence, and that is a dangerous type of existence. But it's how the people solve their conflicts because they don't know how else to do it. Now we're going to go to consensus. Consensus is a win-win model. Everybody wins. Now, once again, I want to say to you that this was taught to me in a secular environment. It is consensus model is so valued in the corporate world that when I sent to Katie my emails with the titles of our topics on it, you know how your email comes through with little advertisements that are linked to some of the words you use in your, well, I have this email at home. I meant to bring it. It's still sitting there by my suitcase. But basically, here are some of the word tags that came up. Global executive training. Dale Carnegie conflict management courses. Executive management conflict resolution strategies. It was proof to me. I knew that the corporate world spends a lot of time and money learning how to reach consensus. How many of you have been trained in consensus? So see your hands. How many of you have been trained in consensus? Do you not think that the peaceable win-win method of consensus should characterize Christians? Believe me, the godless world pays big money for it. Okay? So we're going to go through that model as soon as we see it. Do we have it here? Okay, we have it in the restaurant skit. That's right. Come on in, folks. I think if we did this again, we'd probably cut the first part off. Nobody. Okay, now I want to tell you something very exciting. I learned the steps in win-win in a secular environment where the name of God was not mentioned. And then one day I went reading the Bible. When I tell you, when I say the chapter Daniel 1, what do you think of? What? Daniel 1. The health message, right? Standing for a good diet, right? Is that not what you think of? It's what I think of. Not anymore. And I hope you never are isolated to that again. Let's turn to Daniel. Daniel 1. All the steps in consensus are found in Daniel 1. The very steps I learned in that secular education program. Isn't that exciting? That this young Hebrew had been such a master negotiator that he knew how to go to win-win. So let's go to Daniel 1. And we will go through the steps here. And then at the very end, we'll see a video, if we have time. If we don't have time, we may have to skip it. But it is on the DVD, if you get the DVD, which we have a few. If you're going to be at the booth tonight, don't take the DVD, because you can pick up one there if you want it. But if you don't think you're going to be at the booth tonight and you want a DVD, you can pick it up there at the end. Okay, let's go. The first step in consensus is pick the right time, place, and mood. And I think all of us, and this is found, by the way, in Daniel 1:9. Let's go read it fast. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. I'm going to try to cut this short because we started a few minutes late, 15 minutes late. But I want to give you a scenario. You're a parent. You come home and your teenage son has washed the car and detailed it to a sparkle. You're like, wonder what's going on there. But you walk in, and lo and behold, the kitchen is cleaned. You go past the hallway bathroom, and you knew that there was a bunch of towels and dirty clothes there this morning. Your only person that's been home is your teenage son, and it's immaculate. What do you think?
What do they want?
Or what did they do that they're... Well, what they want is not to get in too much trouble, right? All right. So, we instinctively know to find favor if we're about to ask for something big time. We instinctively know that. And so, when nations get together, they bring gifts and consensus. When corporations get together, they're, you know, we hear of this wine and dine. The lobbyists take out our politicians, really try to smooze them all over, and get, you know, they're after something. And they're going to try. Well, you know, that is a step in consensus building. Find favor. Get something now. It's so much better if you've been a great teenager all around helping out and you're not having to look suspicious just because you did this, right? And that was Daniel's situation. He had found favor. He had found favor. And therefore, he was in a position where he could negotiate. All right, let's go to the next one. State your position clearly. Daniel 1:8. Let's read it. Now, God had found Daniel, had brought Daniel. No, I'm sorry. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. All right, what did Daniel want? He did not want to. It's not that he had something against the king, but the stuff was defiling in his mind. It was contrary to his idea of cleanliness or clean living, and he did not want to defile himself. All right? And he had purposed in his heart that he was not going to do this. So Daniel stated his position real clearly. Now I want to tell you something. You cannot have winners if everybody's position is not known. And the first thing you have to do is state your position. Do you know sometimes people will come in and they'll say, you know how this goes. What's wrong? You can sense it in your roommate, your best friend, your housemate, whatever. You can sense your spouse, your family member. What's wrong? Something's bothering you. No, nothing's wrong. Do you believe it? No. Partly because we look at nonverbals instead of verbals, more importantly, right? But you can work hard to try to find out what's wrong with somebody. And if you're setting the tone, you want to go in and state your position right away. So that part of the bargaining is clear. All right? The third step is find out the need of the other person. This is a step that corporations and nations don't skip if they're doing consensus. But it is a step that we as individuals do skip all the time because we're more concerned about our need being met. Corporations will actually send people to study what's important to the other corporation that they're going to be negotiating with. So will nations. They want to make a winner of the other nation. Can you give me a reason why they would want the other nation to come out of the negotiation of the other corporation feeling like a winner? What? They're more likely to what?
Agree.
Have you ever done business with somebody that was known to always come out on top and the other party to come out second best? Have you ever sense. Somebody gyp you, sell you a car that was no good, or sell you this, or do something, charge you too much for something. If it happens two or three times, guess what? How do you feel about doing business with that person? No. The only way you're going to want to go back and do business is if you feel like you've won some, that you've come out a winner. And so nations and corporations are about to do long-term kinds of relationships. And they need to make sure that they're winners. As far as we as Christians go, we should also be interested in making winners and living peaceably with one another. Okay, so this step here is very important to find out what the need of the other person is. And that is in Daniel 1:10. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. So what was the real need of the chief of the eunuchs? He wanted to keep living. And he knew the king had... king could walk in, see these guys, and say, what's wrong with them? Well, they don't eat off the table, Your Honor. Okay, well, you knew. I mean, gone you are. And it's just like that. You don't have an appeal process. It's done. So he had a very serious... And Daniel understood this. He believed him. He knew he'd hit the real thing, okay? The fourth step is to brainstorm alternatives. And this is the one step that is somewhat doesn't illustrate consensus quite as good as what we're going to try to illustrate it with you, but I'm going to give you a reason in real life that will help you understand that. Tell me what brainstorming means. Anybody ever participated in brainstorming? What is the key element to brainstorming that makes it brainstorming?
Having members of both parties there.
Okay, that's good.
There are no bad ideas.
But how do you do that? Let me just say to you, there is absolutely no evaluation of any idea when it's given. I have a son-in-law who worked for a tech company. He is a tech person. And in his company, there was a small room that was all whiteboard. And it had the whiteboard pencils, just like that one, all around it. And it was nobody occupied that room. And they came in and they wrote their ideas all through the day, through the week. And once a week, they gathered there and went over them. Now, why wouldn't you want somebody, if you came up with an idea and somebody said, ooh, that's a winner, why would that be a bad thing? In tech companies especially, but even in our churches and our families, you may have a person who's a little shy to speak. They're not as comfortable expressing their opinions. When you start shooting down other people's ideas, up, oh, that's not going to work. Ooh, we tried that before. Even with your nonverbals, or your, you know, you don't speak out the words, you kind of pass evaluation, you can cut off the winning idea. Sometimes the winning idea is seated in the heart of somebody who is not going to speak if the ideas are being shot down or evaluated. And why wouldn't they if somebody said, ooh, that's a winner? Because why would I give my idea? They've already picked their winner. So I'm still not going to give it. So true brainstorming, and remember, if you're ever in a brainstorming, it is your job and the job of the leader to make sure everybody knows ahead of time, by no facial expressions, no grunts or smiles or whatever, we do not evaluate these ideas. That's why that tech company had a quiet room where you could go in and write it. Because nobody was there to smile at it, frown at it, grunt at it, poop at it. That's what brainstorming is. And it's really hard to do. Because even when these students were practicing it, there was occasional student that'd say, nope. You know, you don't do that. But now, Daniel didn't brainstorm. Okay? Let's look at what he did do. And that is found in verses 11 to 13. So Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your students for 10 days and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies, and as you see fit, so deal with your servants. Okay. This is a type type of brainstorming, but Daniel came up with the winning idea right away. And let me give you an example. I'm a mother. I have a high school student. He's now in the 9th grade. And he has been going to bed at 8:30, or maybe let's say 9 o'clock, since all middle school, because I really believe in that time before midnight, right? And basically, he's decided, and let's say I'm going to be the student. My name is Jim. I've decided that I want to get a 10 o'clock curfew. After all, my friends have one. And besides, I'm getting into a lot more homework, and I need more time at night. So I'm thinking, I'm going to ask Mom if I can stay up now that I'm in high school. Can I stay up until 10 o'clock? And the first thing that comes to my mind is, oh my, I know what she's going to say. She has to come in and drag me out of bed every morning. And I know she's going to say, what do you mean stay up another hour late? I can't even get you out of bed now. So I go to work on, what would answer that issue? What would answer it? And I can take time to ask you guys the ideas, but since we're running a little short, we got started a little late, I'm just going to give you. He comes up with the winning idea. At least every parent I've asked, and I've asked scores of them in parenting seminars, would you think this is a winning idea? And I have yet to run into the first parent that said no way. He comes to his mom and he says, Mom, look, I need to talk to you about something. She's relaxed. It's a good idea, good time, good place, good move. He says, something real dear to my heart. You know, I've been being in bed with lights out at 9 o'clock since, you know, a long time. And I'm now in high school and I have a lot more homework, Mom. And you know, I like to get good grades, and that was true about Jim. And I'm just not getting it done by 9. So I'd like to make a proposal to you. And that proposal is that I can stay up to 10 o'clock. But just before you say no, I want to say this. I know that you have to drag me out of bed every morning. So I'd like to put this part in the bargain. I will set the alarm clock. Yeah, I know I've had an alarm clock and I sleep through it, but I've got to learn to get myself up. And I will get myself up in the morning. And here's the thing. If I have 3 times that I miss, the first 2, I get grace because I have to learn how to get myself up. If you have to come in after the alarm clock, 2 times I get grace. The 3rd time, I go back to my 9 o'clock curfew, my 9 o'clock bedtime. Anybody here a parent? Who would buy that? Would you buy it? I don't have to pull my kid out of bed anymore. I want him to win. I want him to do this. Am I going to be a winner? Oh, yes. He's getting more time to study. I want him to get good grades. And now I don't have to fuss with him in the morning. That's a win-win. And he comes with that proposal because he spent time thinking up. We don't need to brainstorm anything more. I'm going to buy it. Okay? He's even got a deadline in there of when it would go back to the other. The consequences are built in. So that's a win-win. And you can do that if you know the other person well. Otherwise, you need, if you're a group of multiple people, you need to be ready to brainstorm. Okay? So that's what it was. The next step 5 is choose the best alternative. And that's found in verse 14. So he consented with them in this matter. That's the chief of the eunuchs. And tested them 10 days. Excuse me, that was a steward, the chief steward. And so that he said, okay, this is a good alternative. I'm good. I'm winning. You winning. All right. Then set a date for evaluation. This is 12 and 14. Please test your servants for 10 days and let them give us vegetables. Okay. So he set the date. Now, do you know the psychology behind setting a date is very powerful? You can tolerate almost any change, anything new, if you know it's got an evaluation point. We had that happen at my school. The staff brought an alternative to the, it was a modification of the current schedule with vacation and time off and all that stuff in there. And there were some administrators that were really hung up about that. And then finally I said, why don't we try it for a month or 2 months? I think we may need to meet it for 2 months maybe even. And they said, and at the end of that time, if it's not working, we'll either revise it or we'll go back to the old schedule. And everybody said, yeah, we can live with that. We can live with that. There's something about setting a date. And if you set a date for any radical change or any significant change, you're going to get more people buying in than if you don't. You just say, we want to do it this way. This way we're going to do it. They think, no end. What if it doesn't go well, right? And do you know Daniel knew that way back then? one of the steps in building consensus. And he did it. Isn't that amazing that it's recorded in the Word of God this way? Totally amazing. I'm just so excited about that. Okay? The next one is to set consequences. Sometimes consequences don't have to be set. But Daniel had some consequences, and I want us to take a good look at them. He said, then let our appearance be examined in verse 13, and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies, and as you see fit, so deal with your servants. Now, this was diplomacy at its best. Okay? It's diplomacy at its best. Because Daniel had already purposed in his heart he wasn't going to eat the stuff. What do we know about Daniel when he purposes stuff in his heart? Does he ever go about doing it again? He's willing to die for it, isn't he? He also knew that the chief of the eunuchs was not going to willingly lose his head over this guy's purpose. Where was the authority on earth in this situation? With the chief of the eunuchs. Now, God could intervene, but he might not. All right? So Daniel didn't do, and I think sometimes we as Christians, we get too far ahead and we go, and this is what I'm going to do, Anyway, right? And we destroy the whole process of consensus. Daniel said, look at us, and then do as you see fit. He didn't say, and you do what you see fit, and I know how I'm going to respond to that. Right? He was very diplomatic. He didn't destroy the process by getting adversarial. I wish we could study that more often. Too many times some of us get right in there and get adversarial by staking our ground and holding it out, and we just diffuse all the good that's been done. Such a wise young man. No wonder he spanned many kingdoms. Okay? So that's set the consequences, especially with children you have to do that, but sometimes even with groups of adults. And then the last step is evaluate and proceed with adjustments. Okay? And here they are in verses 15 and 16. And at the end of the 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink, and he gave them vegetables. Was the chief of the steward a winner? He had four outstanding young men. Was Daniel and his friends winners? It was a consensus model, and it involved all winners. And all the steps that I learned in a secular environment are here in Daniel 1. Isn't that awesome? I don't look at Daniel 1 anymore about just being the health message. It's a wonderful model in negotiating win-win. And I hope and pray that when you sit in business meetings and class meetings and stuff like that, that you give it an effort to use it. Now, we are out of time, but we have a skit. The students have done, they're picking their school colors in a short skit. We can show it. If you need to get up and go, feel free to do so, because technically this class is over. And we have a 10-minute break. But if you want to see it all done, you're welcome to stay and see it. If you need to go to get somewhere else to another talk, pick up a DVD. You'll see it on the DVD. But we're going to show it here on the screen right now.
Okay, so now that we've had some great questions, I will get on the study. We're in the classroom today. He says you have to choose a class choice. So does anybody have any specific expectations about the thing you want for colors?
I think the color should not be gender specific.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Okay. Anybody else? Evan?
We should have something that emphasizes our school.
Like what?
Like, we're a Christian school.
Oh, what kind of color would that be?
The color red of the blood of Jesus.
Okay.
Thank you. I think that these colors should, specifically look good on everybody. Something that, doesn't look, make one person look, nasty and the other person look good.
Okay, so now that we've listed
our expectations, we can get into the voting, the brainstorming process. And they can please list colors. So does anybody have any colors that they would like to tell me?
Red and purple.
Okay. Kim?
I think you're selecting gold.
Feel free to come in. We're just watching the DVD here.
Okay, so now that we have a list of colors, you can discuss. So you can say why or why not.
Purple and green, I really don't think that works. Like, they so clash.
Make sure the consensus is what's on.
They would look horrible together. Okay. Does anybody else
consensus? No. So they're taking the wrong one.
I think the gold are very classy colors. I think they also would look on everybody.
Okay. Now that we've discussed, it's time for the voting process. So you can vote for
Note, you can vote for as many as you want with consensus.
So,
it's not one vote.
Honestly, favor of my vote. Two questions in all. Five. Purple and green. Two. And red and gold.
Turquoise and gold. I've never seen too many, school sweaters or polos or anything like that. And turquoise and gold, we should look into that before we go ahead and proceed to buy it. Yeah, will that work for the logo?
Well, you can all do our research on it, and then come back in 2 weeks, which will be the time of our next class meeting, and see if just we can find shirts and our logos will work with those two colors. So, what will happen if it doesn't work out? Okay. So, is that okay with everybody?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the end of the class meeting.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes for those of you who stayed by. You can stand up, stretch, and then we'll go into the next session, which is on fogging, which is the soft answer that turns away wrath. There's a DVD. Those of you who came in late, you may acquire a DVD that is a studio version of this. Just ask you to forgive our many mistakes. We are learning how to do this. We have students that we're working with as well as ourselves. But the content is there. Okay? And if you want to get a DVD on the consensus model, you can get it. There's also going to be a DVD over fogging, but we're basically doing these things live so that we can sort of help you in understanding how this works out in a more real way.
Will it give the Daniel chapter and verse for the answer there? Thank you.
didn't have to worry about that. These are, they're 20 each.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Count that's how we can count them. We just do what we have to we're going to go ahead and get started on this one. This is a talk my husband normally does. And in the beginning, he planned to be here. But it didn't work out. And so I'm going to be doing his talk. And I don't have it down quite as good as he does in terms of content. I don't approach it from the same way that he does. But I think we can get you the skill taught here as we go ahead. So I want to just ask God to be with us, okay? Father in heaven, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here with these wonderful people that have come. Again, Lord, I just ask that you'll speak through me that not only will they sense the Bible basis for this skill, but also be able to learn something to practically apply in their lives. I ask this in your name. Amen. Okay. I have two daughters sitting here. And they are my accountability partners and helpers. You know, one of the nice things about having grown kids is that you exchange places. I spent their childhood, my husband and I, teaching them, and now they are teaching us. Oh my goodness, we're learning so much from our kids, and it's really exciting. So, Lisa, some of you know her. She's Dr. Diller. And then my daughter, Barbara. She's a social worker, a caseworker, and both of them graduated from here. One time, I think we had four girls here, didn't we? Something like that. All four of them have attended, but only three at one time. Okay, I think that's enough. I want to just say again, those of you who were here before, you can ignore this part. But for those of you who were not, it's a really important part to me. And that is this. As I look at how Jesus grew, I look in Luke 2:52. Do you remember how Jesus grew? He grew in what? Wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and in favor with man. That's a four-dimensional growth. As compared to the Old Testament Hebrew, which is a triangle, this is four domains. And as I shared earlier for some of you, not only our church, but most churches actually have been very good at meeting the mental domain, the wisdom. Whenever they go into areas, they start schools. People need to know how to read in order to access the Bible, right? Particularly in modern times and even in the old Hebrew times. And so schools were established by school. Many of our big universities like Harvard and Yale, those were church efforts. So we know as churches that just because you're converted, just because you put a lot of people have an attitude that if you just get your life right with God, it takes care of everything. But we don't believe that really because we teach our kids mathematics and reading and writing, and we have school systems to do that. We know that conversion does not teach you how to read. Okay? We also know that conversion doesn't necessarily solve your allergy or teach you how to cook a healthy meal or to take care of your body system. So we teach that intentionally. We also teach the spiritual domain intentionally. We have schools that teach Bible and all its ramifications. We have schools, short-term schools, that teach evangelism and get people out to do evangelism, schools of evangelism. So we know conversion doesn't just solve the even spiritual learning that we need to do. We need intentional teaching. But traditionally in our church, and those of us who are older are more aware of this, when there was a social problem, when a person came to church and said, I think my kid is doing drugs. The only response you knew was to pray about it, right? Or my husband, I think, is developing a relationship. Or my wife, I believe, she doesn't love me anymore. Well, brother, let's just pray about it. You know, get close to God. He'll take care of that. We have not intentionally talked to the social domain. And this is what our ministry is about. Well, it's a media ministry, but we are really focusing on the social domain. If you have a special interest in that, you can leave your email address. And as we produce, we have about 28 topics that we know right now we're going to be producing that have everything to do with how the thoughts control your behaviors and what to do about bringing your thoughts into captivity, and has to do with broken trust, rebuilding broken trust, being assertive, holding your own against pressure, the whole gamut of the social life. And if you're interested in these things, let us know. And we will let you know what we have out as we produce them. Okay? And I think that you can leave that there, your email, or come to our booth, and we've been collecting email addresses too. So today we're going to talk about the true soft answer that turns away wrath. A lot of people think that's silence. Have you ever been met with silence that did not turn away your anger? Okay, so you know that. So now we're going to get right to what that is. And first off, we're going to start with a skit. And Ryan and I haven't reviewed these well. And like I say, these are my husband's. So I hope we're on the right skit here. This is an older sister who has to drive a younger sister to school. And is not, you know, even if she says to her dad, I'm going to go off and leave her, the father says, yeah, and you'll lose your car privileges because they're gone to work already. So the older sister is stuck with trying to get the younger sister, who's constantly late, to school. It's just a little synopsis here.
Hurry up. You take longer than anyone I know to get ready for school. Well, that's because you don't know anyone. Maybe if you made a few friends, you'd realize, well, no, I am normal. You're not normal. You've been late to school already 3 times. No normal person gets that many parties to school. Get out of the car now. You get out. Leave me alone. I've got to finish my hair.
Anybody ever heard anything like that happen in your life? Okay. Having raised 4 daughters and 2 sons, I would say that is not an unusual thing that could have happened in our house, right? All right. The first thing that we think about when we are dumped on with a put down or criticism is kind of defending ourselves. And the defense goes back and forth. Like when she said, you know, you are the slowest person I know, the other person shot back with a gun, basically. It pulled a sword on her and said, that's because you don't know anybody. Maybe if you knew people, you know, you'd find out how normal I am. And then the other one says, you're not normal. You know, I mean, it's back and forth. So there's been no soft answer that turns away wrath. Defensiveness is an instinct of our carnal nature. And there is a statement my husband quotes a lot from the Spirit of Proverbs that says defensiveness is sin. And that's because that's how we're built in. And I'd like to take you to John, the first chapter. Okay, the book of John, to the first chapter. If you have your Bibles, go with me and we'll read it here. Okay. This was about the Word. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and all of this. And then it said that in Him was life, and life was the light of man, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. And basically, we learn that in John 3, verses 19 and 21 as well. It clarifies this. John talks about this. And this is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world and men love darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. For everyone practicing evil hates the light and does not come to the light lest his deeds should be exposed. But he who does the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be clearly seen that they have been done in God. In other words, when we are, when we're non-defensive, we're okay with people shining light on us, all right? And we look at our deeds, are they straight with God or are they not? We are in a modality of personal growth. We are seeking accountability. And that is what fogging is all about. Now, I had an interesting experience. Once again, we learned fogging, Bill and I, years and years ago. And but recently I got a hold of a book. It was in the box of books of one of my daughters, called When I Say No, I Feel Guilty. And you know what I discovered in this book? This was the guy who came up with fogging. He tells a story of how he was assigned to come up with certain things with clients he was working with, and he really studied the process and came up with this response, which his graduate students all started labeling fogging. And, of course, fogging is going, it's all around. You can read about it in all kinds of books now. It's a common technique. And it is a technique that is turns out to be the soft answer. It is just amazing. Now, the reason they call it fogging, do you have a picture of the fog, Brian? You don't. Okay, we have on the DVD a picture of fog. Picture the mountains with the fog in it. All around you, the fog. What happens if you go out there and hit the fog or strike back or take a sword or anything? What does it do any good, does it? The fog just stays there. Does it go away? No. Does it hit back? Mm-hmm. That's why they call it fogging. It is, it's just really, it makes a, it's the soft answer. Okay? And, you know, God has some counsel for us in 1 Peter 2:23. Let's look at that one too. And read what that one, this one says. 1 Peter 2:23. It says, who, this is Christ, when he was reviled, did not revile in term, in return. Okay? So, this is an effort to not revile, to get back. But here's what I have found. That if I don't have something else to do, my instinct is to give it back. Now, I am a choleric temperament, so I like a good fight, all right? Or at least I don't run from it. I'm going to tell you something a little humorous here. My husband and I at one time were attending classes. And by the way, bring me back to this little story, but I want to say this. I'm up here not because I'm an expert. My husband and I grew up in families, single mother families, back when guilt and some other rather dysfunctional ways of handling kids were used. And we neither had seen a good marriage, no daddy in either home. And so we began to scramble when we got together, big time, to learn how to improve, how to grow, how to change. And the very things that we teach you about are many times the areas that are our weaknesses that we had to learn. We're not standing, we don't stand up in as a person who's an expert. We're like, as my husband says, one beggar telling another beggar where to go for bread. All right? We had to learn these things. We run a school. We founded a school. We don't run it anymore. For at-risk youth. Kids whose parents have lost control of them. And it's called Miracle Meta School. And the whole social domain grew out of that. All right? Because a lot of these kids, the Bible has a principle that says, overcome evil with good. So you can tell a kid, don't act this way, but replace it with something else. Right? And so this was our effort. I can know, don't get defensive, Gail, when somebody puts you down. But if I haven't worked on learning a replacement, it's so much easier for me to get defensive, right? So that's all we're doing, is sharing with you from God's Word and from practical skills how to replace something things that you don't particularly like. Now, do I always do this? I've got two people here who can tell you I don't. If I'm going into a situation where I thought about it ahead of time, I do quite well. If I'm broadsided, woo, my carnal nature clicks in, and I'm mopping up afterwards. I'm going to tell you now what I told you to remind me of. We were in a seminar one time about temperaments and the extrovert and introvert temperaments. Have you all been familiar with that, the extrovert versus the introvert? We're described as a turtle and a skunk. Now, my husband has some extrovert in him, but he has some strong traits of the turtle because he is also probably more known for his phlegmatic, easygoing, peace-at-any-price temperament than anything else. And he is a peace-at-any-price. So he's an outstanding fogger because it does away with the conflict. He does it instinctively, naturally. I see it in my marriage all the time. All right? He has a shell. And when the stink happens, he crawls in. And I'm out there, I'm the stinker, pounding on his shell saying, come out and face it. Now, I'm a skunk, and I am double whammy skunk. I have no introvert in me. I am double extrovert. And so what do skunks do? Anybody know about skunks? They stamp their feet two or three times to let you know things have got to change or something's going to happen. Little skunks out in the woods do this. You can see them stamping their feet. That means get out, I'm warning you, okay? And then what happens if you just keep right on coming? And you know something? Everybody knows it. And I spent many years of my marriage wishing I had my husband's temperament. And he said, honey, I have sins of commission. It's what I don't do that hurts people. With a skunk, it's what you do that hurts people, right? I told my husband, I wish I had a shell. I wish I did. But I don't. I don't know how to crawl in a shell. So we've had a lot of fun with this in our marriage. He's become much more assertive, and I've learned to calm down a bit. Okay? But let me tell you, I'm here to share these skills with you because I've needed them probably more than him. Right? I'm always mopping up the stink. So I'm not here telling you this because I'm some great psychologist that knows all about this and I practice this in my life so very faithfully and you need to be like me, right? I'm telling you, here's what I have struggled with and here's what I found that helps, okay? If you can take it and run with it, praise God. So we're going to talk about fogging today. It is the soft answer that turns away wrath. And here's the first step in it. The first is only two steps I'm going to share with you today. The first step is to agree. They're both A's. Agree with the element of truth. Almost every put down or criticism has some portion of truth in it. Okay, you're always late. Why can't you ever be anywhere on time? Well, you've just quickly thought of the three times in the last 6 months you were on time. So that's not a true statement. I am not always late. I get to places on time more than you realize just because you're not there. And there you go, right? But if you agree with the element of truth, you're saying to yourself, you know, I do have trouble with that. And so you say something like this. It's true. You don't say, I'm always late, because you can't buy that as the truth, right? That always makes it not true. So you say, it's true. I do have a problem getting to places on time sometimes. You should see this when it's used. If it's used in a real thing, our students use it. Our staff use it. I taught it over in California at a Christian facility being established for at-risk youth up in the Shasta Mountains. And I got a call a week later, and the director was saying, oh, my goodness, we are using fogging all over the place, and it totally dissipates. It's just like the wind goes out of the sail. So you learn. learn. How do you remember to do this? Because as soon as somebody says that to you, they broadsided you, right? And you're instinctively going to go to defensiveness, especially if you're my temperament, right? Now, if you're my husband's temperament, you may crawl in the shell, shut it down real quick, right? But if you have my temperament, you don't got no shell and you're not crawling anywhere. You're going to pull a sword, right? Anybody identify with me? Okay. All right. Give me a... I can hold my own here, you know? All right. So, like I said, come on in, ladies. We're just having a good time here, and you can just walk right in if you want to. Okay? Some seats up here. Yeah, come right along. That's good. Come right along here. So, as soon as you agree with the person, with the element, please let me emphasize the word element. Okay, we got some seats up there. Can you go on up there to where he is? Okay. We're running out of seats. There's one right over here. Okay. You guys want to come in? I don't think there's any seats left. All right. As soon as you agree with the element of truth, just like that. Now, I'm going to teach you a second A in case it doesn't work. All right? So let's see the video that shows the same scene done up with... Is it done up with it done right, Ryan?
There's one with the silent.
Oh, this is the silent one. Okay, we're going to do the silent treatment right now. Okay, we agreed that the silent treatment was not a soft answer. Okay.
Where have you been? He told me he was home for supper.
Well, that's the next one.
Always let.
It's okay if we don't get it. It's all right. It's ready for school, too.
Can you hurry up? You take longer than anyone I know to get ready for school.
Have you ever had that? Anybody do that to you? All right. And it doesn't take away your anger. It makes you worse sometimes, doesn't it? Okay. So now let's go to the first skit. My husband and I did these. Because we had kind of run out of time, and getting the students on board can take a little more time. So we're going to go to Late for Supper 01, and this is where, I'm not sure. Let's see what it is.
Where have you been? He told me you'd be home for supper at 8:30. You're always late.
You're right, sweetheart. I am late more often than I should be or could be.
All right. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, that is what fogging sounds like. Now, you have to practice that. And you need to learn and memorize the introductory phrase you like to use. You're right, honey, or you're right, or it's true. All you have to memorize is those two words, you're right or it's true, and say it again and again. Make a groove in your brain, because as soon as you get to the end of those two words, you'll know what to say. If you don't have those two words memorized, you may get hung up on your emotions and not say it. Okay? You're right, it's true. Pick the one you want to use that sounds more like you, or come up with something else that's very close. And memorize it and practice it. If you've got somebody that's consistently putting you down, or an area of your life that gets a lot of put down, pretend, get someone even to role play it with you, somebody's close to you. Or if not, say it out loud, and you practice verbally saying a fogging statement back. I am. If there's any skill that can give you immediate results, it's that one. Now, when it comes to, you know, doing fogging, we have to understand that most people will quit there. But in case they don't, we can actually go to another step, and that step is the ask for help. When somebody continues to put us down. And by the way, if you do ask for help, you should be prepared to receive it. Do not ask for help if you don't intend to get it. Okay? But if you are pushed to the wall and you're fogging, and we're going to show fogging in this little situation where it continues to be done. The book, When I Say No, I Feel Guilty, this counselor takes people who are not assertive, we're talking about taking something back to the store that is defective and letting the storekeeper talk you into keeping it. Okay, anybody ever had anything like that? Or somebody or a store will not give you your money back. Or you going in to ask for a raise and somehow you can't get it from a boss. And you don't have what it takes to keep going. Okay, you hear the put downs or whatever. It has all kinds of situations. These people come in and they train, but they actually, the trainer just levels put down after another, and every time they have to come up with a fog. Every time. And that's how they learn to do it on their feet. And it takes usually, they meet once a week, and it takes 2 or 3 weeks before you become really good at it. So when we just do it once, it's not going to train you. You've got to practice it and practice it. If you don't have someone you're comfortable telling somebody, keep giving me put downs, let me practice it, then you better do it between you and your imagination if you're going to get good at it. Okay? All right. Then if somebody continues to come at you, then you ask for help. Okay? And by asking for help, it would be something like this. Okay, well, you're being put down because you keep forgetting things or whatever, right? And you would say, well, usually we say you don't remember everything so well yourself. But you could say, you seem to be real sensitive about remembering things. You mind giving me some hints? I'd be willing to take some hints, okay, or some help. And then once you ask that person for help, they're on your side now. You've totally erased the controversy, right? Can you see how that works? Jesus did this with the woman at the well. When you ask somebody for help, it actually honors them, right? Because they're saying, you know something I don't know. And I'd really like to hear from you. That's an honor. That's why what Jesus did to the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman no less, the immoral woman no less, who had had 5 men and was now living with somebody who was not her husband, he honored her in more ways than one. He gave her a statement about his messiahship that I can't read in the Bible any time before that point. But he asked her for help, which was an unheard of thing for a Jew to ask a Samaritan dog, male, let alone woman, let alone immoral woman, for something. It meant that the Jew was saying, you've got something I need. I need you to help me. Oh, they wouldn't do it. Powerful, though. In fact, she says, how is it you, a Jew man, asked me, a Samaritan woman, for a drink of water? Remember that statement there in the Bible? If you studied it, you know it's there. She's blown away. Okay, asking for help gives respect and honor to the other person, which further dissipates the put down. But if you plan on ignoring what they say, I wouldn't go to that step. Right? However, if you are coming to the light and not being defensive, you are trying to seek input about your life. You are wanting to grow. You are willing for someone else to help you. Right? Then you can ask for help. Why? And there's a beautiful statement found in Philippians. And let's look at that right now. See where it is. Philippians 2, 3, and 4. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness. lowliness of mind. Let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. If you've got that spirit, by the way, this is looking at the spirit of Christ, who thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but took the form of a servant, a slave. So this is the spirit that as Christians we long to enter into. People who are criticizing us can teach us. So in some ways we need to look at them as our teachers. And then, of course, that's mental gymnastics in some ways at the moment of the criticism. That's why fogging is a very good technique to help put you back into that. Okay? All right. So what we're going to do now is look at the skit. I think we'll look at the skit of Bill and I, Late for Supper, and then we're going to go to the other skit to sort of see how this goes.
Where have you been? You told me you'd be home for supper, and it's 8:30. You're always late.
You're right, sweetheart. I am late more often than I could be or should be. I noticed that you have a real sense of being on time. I wonder if you might be able to help me develop some strategies that will help prevent some of this in the future.
Okay, did you see that? And, you know, of course, I was going to be very willing to help him, right? However, what if you said something like this, and the person came back and said, I have told you 100 times, if I've told you once, what you could do to be on time. Now, is that something you might hear from somebody in your life? Would anybody ever come back like that to you? It could happen. Have you ever heard it in your family or in your place? Yeah. Okay. So why, you know, so it's still going, right? And so what would you do to fog it if that person said that to you? It's true. You have said things that you thought I could do, and I really haven't incorporated them. Okay. And so what in the world gives me the idea to think that you're going to do it now? It's true. I could see why you would think that it's not going to do any good to help me. And you want me to try helping you again? What do you want me to do? Set me up for disappointment? Well, that's true. I could see why if you tried to help me and I didn't respond, you would be disappointed. Sooner or later, you're going to run out of steam, right? I mean, sooner or later, this is a soft answer that turns away wrath. It takes a little longer, maybe once in a while. Fortunately, don't get upset about, or don't get worried or afraid of, you know, this, because almost, well, way more than 50% of the time, potentially close to 80, 85% of the time, maybe even 90, the first fog takes care of it. But occasionally, you have very entrenched disagreements and entrenched attitudes, and it doesn't take care of it. And so you have to keep doing it. You just have to keep fogging it. And then, you know, eventually the person might come around and say, and so I want to know, do you really want help this time? And at that point in time, you might say, I'd like to have some help, but I wonder if we could talk about some of the ground words, rules first. Okay? Is any comfort to you? We never did solve that problem in our marriage. He's sure good at fogging. We did solve it. I'm going to tell you how we solved it. You want to know how we solved it? We have plenty of time here. We're going to get out a little early. When we sat down and talked about it, we agreed that my husband would never tell me when he was coming home. He's a pastor. He does most things in the evening, you know. And any pastors here? No. Well, one. Okay. And sometimes he'd say, honey, I'm going to try to get home early tonight. I'll probably be home by 8:30 or whatever, you know. Well, I'm sitting there thinking, oh, I've got everything, and I'm real excited he's coming. I felt like I was stood up on a date, right? Every single time. He wouldn't come in till 10:30, 11 o'clock. And he'd come in, and he would say, oh, honey, the Holy Spirit just led. It was so wonderful. What do you do? At first, I was just like... And finally, one day, as our marriage progressed through years, I said to him, will you quit blaming God? I'm going to get mad at him next. You know? Let's talk about you with this. We got to solve this problem because I like to get to places early. I used to. He's rubbed up on me a lot, you know? And he's gotten better about getting to places on time. It's the nice thing about marriage. When you've been married 40 years, there's a blending there that goes on, you know? And so we came up with a solution. Basically, that he would not make any commitments to me about time. Because that was what it was hard about. He made a commitment, I trusted it, you know? And that constituted violated trust to me when he makes a commitment. So he never said, I'll be home at a certain time. If he started to, I'll say, erase that. I don't want to hear it. I'm not counting on it. You just get home when you can. I'll be happy to see you. That's how I resolved it. Okay? But believe me, he's a great fogger. Just this past week, he fogged a couple of things. And I thought, sure, he's so good. But it's natural to him because he's the turtle. He don't want the conflict. Peace at any price. And you know, the Bible does say, brethren, insofar as in us it lies, let us live peaceably with all people. Right? And that's our mandate as Christians. So being a peacemaker is a beautiful thing. And I love and admire that about my husband. So anyway, that's what happens. Now, what we're going to do now is take a look at the last skit. And I think we're getting along here pretty good. We might have some time with some examples or back and forth question or discussion here. But we're going to see them do the Ready for School skit, and they're going to use the whole process. Okay?
Will you hurry up? You take more than anyone I know to get ready for school. I do usually take on getting myself ready than other people in this house. You always make me late, and I hate it.
Yes, it's true. We've been late to places at times.
And you know, I hate being late to places.
Yes, I do know that.
I don't even care that we get penalties at school for being tardy.
Yes, true. I don't mind tardies as much as you do.
Do you know that if you're late at your job just once, you can get fired?
Yes, you have told me that before.
And if you keep getting fired, you can't get any good job offices for a better job, or any job like that. You'll starve, all because you can't get to work on time.
You're right. I could go hungry if I told you that.
So why don't you do something about it?
You know what? You're so good at being to places on time. Maybe you could give me a few pointers on not being late. Are you upset?
Are you serious?
Yes. I know I need to work to improve in this area. Are you willing?
Well, if you really want to learn,
let's give it a try.
Okay. So that gives you an idea. All right. We have mandates to live peaceably one with another. We have mandates not to be defensive, but rather to come to the light about ourselves. God knows this is the way we grow as Christians. And this simple little skill of fogging is a practical help in how to do it. Some of you will do it so much more natural than the rest of us. But we can all learn. And some of us who don't do it naturally are the people who need it the most, right? Is there anything, any situation or any questions you want to ask about this before we end here? Has it been pretty clear? How many of you think, just give me a little hand here, how many of you think there's a possibility that you could apply this and that you actually have room to do it? I mean, there's need for it. Okay, good. That's great. Remember, these skills in interpersonal relationships are just like learning to type or ride a bicycle or anything. Remember when you first started riding a bike? You came out, you picked up the bike, you put it up, you had to get the pedals just so, right? Turn them just so they were so, and you're sitting there and it's going here and there, and you get your foot over, and oh, it's a long, drawn out process. And then you get to where you do it so well that you can come flying out of the house when you're a kid, grab your bike, you're holding a bottle of something, jump on it, take off, and you haven't even thought about a single movement, right? Well, this is how skills develop. And for most of us, some of us, we run against the current of our basic nature. So it's a little harder for us to learn some things. Like for me, the skill of assertiveness, piece of cake. My husband, tough going. Okay? Tough going. For me, fogging, tough going. For him, piece of cake, you know? So because we're different temperaments, we get to see how we all play this off. It really pays not to cast judgment. We all have our areas of struggle. And we help each other grow. And that's what friends are for. Give your friends permission to help you grow. If you give them permission, they can get you in a situation or watch you with somebody and walk away and say, hey, Susie, that was a great time to be enabled to fog. You want to practice how you could do that another time? If you give them permission. If you don't give them permission, they're going to feel uncomfortable doing this. It was one thing that I loved about working at the school. We were all working on our problems, not just the students, but the staff. And I gave the students and the staff permission to help me grow. You talk about an accountability. I really miss it since I'm retired. I had daily accountability there, and it is just really great. I mean, it's, of course, it has uncomfortable components to it, but if you give people permission to help you grow, then it makes a real. I remember a situation years ago when one of my daughters confronted me on the phone and said, I feel like you're laying a guilt trip on me right now. And boy, I have a childhood with guilt of being, you know, I mean, parents using guilt, and that's a lot. I said, oh my goodness, I couldn't even identify how I'd done it. But I said, every single time you get the feeling that I'm laying guilt on you, will you please call me on it? Because I don't want to do this. And she explained it to me, and you know, that's how I grow, right? And so I just want to commend you all to Jesus and encourage you to grow in the social domain, in favor with man. Jesus did. He's our example. Okay, let's take a break then.